For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, I want to welcome everyone here from across our fellowship and across our city, across our country, and across the world as well. We're so glad you're here. We've been at this for, 21 years. That's an amazing thing to think about. The Summer Institute, as it was originally conceived, is kind of a conversation at the crossroads of the biblically informed mission of the church and secular culture to whom we have our calling. And so it has always been that place where we come together and we bring in people from the outside, leaders in thought and action in the evangelical world, around the world, to help us walk through some of the really important issues that we face, the things that we really need to figure out if we're going to be able to maintain that strong voice in our culture. And so we're just so pleased this year to have an international cast of speakers from England, from Sri Lanka, from Colorado, that country out west, places like that, to come and just kind of facilitate for us those conversations that we need to have if we're going to be the people that God has called us to be in this moment in time and in this place. And every year we come up with a different topic to get that conversation going. And this year we're going to do it on the subject of love. So, hey, that can't be bad. What's controversial about love? Anyway. And all you need is love. You know, every generation has their love songs and love anthems, and the Bible does too. I think it's really amazing that we've had this conference for as many years as we have and not really taken this topic straight on. Because this really is that key thing of where what our culture longs and what the Bible provides really intersects right at this place. And just in terms of the emphasis of Christianity in relation to love, if you look at the key words in the New Testament, agapeo in the Old Testament, chesed, and related cognates from there, over 700 uses of the word love in the Bible. That's, if there are 66 books in the Bible, that's over 10 occurrences in each book. It's just absolutely the main thing that drives the Bible story and the biblical God. So what we want to do this evening is just to kind of set the table here and get a discussion going, having defined some terms and understanding why what we're talking about is so incredibly important to who we are as a church. Then each of the workshops and plenary sessions that come after are going to fill in a considerable way the details of what's been said. So we want to really look at two objectives as we get things started here tonight. The first is that we want to consider this whole issue of love from the standpoint of the power and the centrality of love in Christian life and in Christian witness. So there is an apologetic element to this. There is a consequence involved in whether we get this straight that relates to the voice that God calls us to have in our culture. The second one is like it. It is the practical ways, the how-tos to demonstrate the love of God and the pitfalls that are common to our failures in these areas. So we want to really work in both worlds. We want to talk conceptually about why is this such a critically important thing, and then we want to talk practically. How do we do this and how do we do it well? So let's just get the ball rolling. The title of my talk tonight is God is Love. And with that said, borrowing from the work of Francis Schaeffer, who is in so many ways so critically important to the development of this fellowship in terms of being a thinking person, a thinking Christian who wants to engage culture in its own terms. Schaeffer wrote a book some years ago called The Mark of the Christian, and one of the real important chapters in that is called The Final Apologetic. Love is the final apologetic. Love is what speaks to people, even in a more profound way often than truth itself, although obviously those things are deeply related, and we're going to have to unpack the relationship between those things even here tonight. But what is it that shows the reality of God. It is the reality of Christian love. Because why? Because it speaks so poignantly and so powerfully to the human condition. And here is just something that we need to be aware of, that the language of love, the need for love, is absolutely transcultural. It's universal. It informs the art, the literature, the longings of people in every culture and at all times. You might have heard an expression like this: what the world needs is Christian love or compassion. I wonder who wrote that. Probably Pope Francis or Mother Teresa or something like that. Interestingly, no. The most popular atheist of the last century wrote that, Bertrand Russell, in his book Human Society and Ethics and Politics, where he just basically concedes at a point that the real answer is to the human social context is love, and that there isn't, within the framework of his own atheism, the way to define that in a way that truly satisfies. In the psychological area, Eric Fromm, the psychoanalyst, wrote in his book, The Art of Loving, that a lack of love is at the root of all psychological problems. And that just seems to be really consistent, too, with the findings of sociologists and criminologists as they reflect upon deviant behavior, criminal behavior, people who are not adjusted within themselves or with their neighbor, that there are deep connections between those problems that people are facing and the lack of love in their life. The absence, for instance, of a loving father figure is directly connected in criminology to criminal behavior. What we're talking about here is not a desire that is to be satisfied. We're talking about a need, something that must be met, because that is our design as creatures in the image of God. And so, because of the universal need for love, there will always be common ground for effective Christian communication. There will always be a place for us to talk. There will always be a felt response as we are obeying with integrity and authenticity the call to love as the Bible describes it. Because in doing so, we are speaking that deep felt need, that language that is universal and cross-cultural. And so, without the biblical framework for love, and outside of a relationship with He who is the source of all love, the people of our culture will always be in tension between their own deep human desires to have a satisfying love relationship and the experience that they have in this world, and their own secular worldviews that really cannot incorporate in a satisfying way the reality of what they know they need from within. And so there is a tension with everyone that we're interacting with, no matter who they are, no matter what their credentials, no matter how much they seem, perhaps, to have it together in a deep and fundamental way. Anyone outside of a living relationship with the God who is love is at a deficit and is at tension within themselves. I really like the way that Alan Bloom, the author of The Closing of the American Mind, some years ago put it. As he was noticing the university students at the University of Chicago, where he taught literature, and over a period of many years began to just see that as a biblical view of humankind and human society was fading, that the human cost was extraordinary. And so he writes, there is a quest, but ever more hopeless, for arrangements and ways of putting the broken pieces back together. He says, the task is equivalent to squaring the circle because everyone loves himself the most, but wants the others to love him more than they love themselves. Well, how well said. That is the dilemma of our culture. Our culture tells us, go out and find love, like it's a conquest. Go out there and find that person and make them that one who's going to have that role in your life to meet that deep need for love. And everyone, all you know, out there looking for the other to do something for them, ends up in a very predatory environment. Ends up in a place where everyone walks away unfulfilled, unsatisfied. So yes, there is a place for the final apologetic. There is a way that we can speak loudly and powerfully to our culture because of the very circumstance that our culture finds itself in. What I want to do this evening in a brief way is to talk about the meaning of love as the Bible defines it, the message of love as the gospel declares it, and the mission of love that God called, or Christ calls his disciples to. So those three things, beginning first then with the meaning of love. Let's define our terms. What is it that we mean exactly when we say God is love, as John affirms in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 16? This term love, agapeo, as it's used in the New Testament, was a term that was not in broad currency in the first century Roman world. It was a known term, but not referred to a lot. And I think that the biblical writers in the early church seized upon this rarely used term because they could then fill it with their own distinct meaning. In much the same way that in recent decades, in the ashes of World War II, Elie Wiesel could rise up as a survivor of the concentration camps and trying to describe their experience and the experience of European Jewry. What word would describe this? How about a word that means a burnt sacrifice? The word that hardly is ever used, but it still has an established meaning, but a meaning that we can fill and animate with our experience. How about we call it Holocaust? And that move galvanized the whole thinking of the post-war Jewish people and as a rallying point to express their experience and as a warning to the world for what is it that can lead to these things. And in that same way, in an analogous way, really, it seems to me that the New Testament's use of agapeo fits into that. A very fairly vague term that is animated with the meaning that the Bible brings to it. When we talk about love, then, in a biblical sense, really we're talking about a constellation of characteristics. What we're talking about is first that love is not a feeling state. There is that. That's what erotic love is. But agape love is by its nature not really rooted in moods and feeling states and attraction, but in action, and specifically sacrificial action. So God so loved the world that he gave, John 3:16, his one and only son. It's sacrificial. And so I like the way J.P. Phillips puts this in Making Men Whole as he reflects on this verse. He says, God really did enter with vulnerability, he says, unarmed at our level. He really is love, not someone pretending to be love with a big stick within easy reach. When it says that God sent his one and only son into the world, he sent him there with all the vulnerabilities of a child that grows up essentially under a political oppression in deep poverty. For many years, perhaps under the roof of a single parent, rejected by his own people. That is sacrifice that ultimately takes him, of course, to the ultimate sacrifice, the cross. For what purpose? So that he could give unmerited favor to those who do not deserve it. Romans 5 verse 8 says that while we were still enemies of God, he died for us. Enemies. And so love, as God defines it, is not something that we ever deserve. We never should ask God for what we deserve. It is what he chooses to give to us out of the abundance of who he is, a blessing that is utterly undeserved. You know, there are other religious faiths that talk, at least in superficial terms, about love. Mostly, at least in the Asian religions, it's about harmony. And love really only plays a small role, really, in that. In Islam, too, one of the 99 names for Allah, number 47, actually, in the list, is love. But it is defined very specifically that Allah, or God, loves those who love him. And so it is fundamentally unique and distinctive that we find in the pages of the scriptures, both Old Testament and New, an understanding of love that is utterly one-sided in this way. It is from God to us. And thirdly, then, that God's love is unselective. In Luke 10, the story of the Good Samaritan, in answer to this question, who is my neighbor? If I'm supposed to love my neighbor, who's my neighbor? And Jesus is just making it really clear, your neighbor is anyone who has need of you. It is utterly unselective with respect to the recipient of our love. And lastly, that there is a robust moral framework also for love. That love is redemptive. That love seeks the good of the one who is love. And so the author of Hebrews can tell us in Hebrews 12, verse 6, that what father is there who loves his son who doesn't discipline him? Of course. Love and discipline must come together. Or as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 6, that love does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in the truth. Why? Because the commitment that love is to the good of the person who we love. And there's no such thing as doing right by the person we love outside of the moral and truth categories that the scriptures bring to us. And so that is, in a broad sketch, I guess, really, when we talk about what are we really talking about? We're talking about love that fits along these lines. And now, just again, sort of from the standpoint of how to speak to our culture. And why does this matter? Because what most people believe in our culture actually eliminates the very possibility of this thing that they seek. The possibility of love has very narrow parameters. What kind of world has to exist for there to be love? Well, at least three things come to mind. There are probably more. But the first is that reality, who we are as individuals, what the world is about, has to be inherently personal. That love is relational. It is not merely a bag of chemicals moving toward another bag of chemicals for the sake of reproduction or conquest or whatever it is, survival. That love is a relational concept and inherently assumes the personal, that inextricably at the base of who we are as both givers and recipients of love is we are persons seeking relationship. Second, that we live in a world in which the commitment of love is entered into freely, not determined by the chemical reactions of neurobiology or hormones or whatever it is that drives mechanistic animals that are free of choice. Love is a choice. Love is a commitment that we choose to enter into. An automaton can never love. Your Stepford wife will never love you. Or husband, or whatever it is. And lastly, love presumes the intrinsic value of the person who is loved. That there is something about you that is worth. Not what you can do for me. Not how you fit into nature or whatever. But something that is at the root of it, you matter. No matter what you've done or who you are or where you've been, you matter. You're worth it. And these things would be required of this robust framework that the Bible gives for love. And for that reason, everyone who seeks that kind of love, that love that is unmerited, that love that is unselective, that love that is entered into freely, that love that seeks relationship at the core, everyone who seeks these things is seeking something that can only and uniquely be found in the biblical framework of who is God and what does it mean to be creatures in the image of God. And so, it is as though our world, without knowing it, is borrowing resources, is borrowing capital from the Bible bank of ideas and of truth, and is using these assumptions as they move toward other to seek these love relationships that God has created us in His image to find. But I think we have something to say. This is the point to our culture, something very powerful. The very thing our culture seeks, we are in a position to demonstrate. Let's talk secondly about the message of love. What is the message of love? It is, as the football verse says, God so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son, that whosoever would believe in Him would not perish but have eternal life. Yes, that's exactly what the message of love is. When love meets the unlovely, which is to say, you and me, there's a term for that. It's called grace. Grace is love demonstrated for the unworthy. It is that choice to sacrifice unselectedly, without merit, for the good and for the interests, the true interests of those who are, like you and me, utterly unworthy. Love, grace is love for the unworthy. In the New Testament's world, and I think pretty much in today's world as well, this idea is both foolish and scandalous. Look what Paul said to the Corinthians. He said, "We preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Gentiles foolishness." Well, why is it a stumbling block to the Jews? Because it is the end of self-righteousness. That's why. The cross says no to your merit. The cross says there's nothing that you can do to earn God's acceptance. That if you were to have favor with God, it is something that entirely rests with Him, and about which you bring nothing to the table. And so for prideful, especially religious types, this is a very offensive message. To receive the love of God is to come with empty hands, asking for undeserved favor, asking for mercy. That's never going to be an easy sell to a religious mind. But Paul's not just talking to the religious mind, he's also talking to the Gentile mind, and to them, the love of Christ manifested by the cross is complete foolishness. Foolishness. Why would God incarnate Himself as a man, take on flesh, subject Himself to a creation in rebellion against Him, and submit Himself to death on a cross? And then have that corpse, after 3 days, raised from the dead. That's crazy. That's foolish. Here's the Greco-Roman mindset. E.A. Young has written an essay, this is some years ago now, called The Quest for Mercy in Late Antiquity. He's a historian. He says, classical philosophers regarded mercy and pity as pathological emotions, defects of character to be avoided by all rational men. Since mercy involves providing unearned help or relief, it was contrary to justice. Mercy is not governed by reason, and humans must learn to curb the impulse. The cry of the undeserving for mercy must go unanswered. And so, yes, we may feel some inner sympathy for one who is suffering because of their own folly most of the time. And we must just brace ourselves and harden ourselves to their cries and their pleas, and to recognize that they are getting what justice demands, and that to move towards them and to show mercy is to set the universe out of balance. You know what Jesus did when he died on the cross? He set the universe out of balance. The reality is that the grace of God is fundamentally unjust from God's perspective. He didn't deserve the death that he endured on our behalf. And we certainly do not deserve the pardon that his blood purchased. And so in this way, in the world in which Christianity emerged and thrived and has brought us to this day, both from the religious side and from the secular philosophical side, the cross of Christ, which is that central demonstration of the love of God, completely makes no sense. There is, in the cross of Christ and in the love of God, his mercy, both a judicial and a relational aspect. The judicial side grants pardon to us who are guilty. It's what we call justification. The relational side is that we have an opportunity to change where we are in relation to God. That we go from outsiders to insiders. From people who are not the people of God to sons and daughters, to children of God. And it is so fascinating when you see how God in the Old Testament really views a father-son relationship between God and the nation of Israel. Jesus really turns that on his head. And in the New Testament, you see this clearly in the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, in Matthew chapter 6. The repeated calls of Christ for his disciples to appeal to God as Father. And all of the intimacy and significance that that term represents. And so when we think about being the recipients and the object, the subjects of God's love, both in its judicial and relational aspects, I really find myself in agreement with J.I. Packer in his book, Knowing God. He has a chapter on adoption, and he simply says this. He says, adoption is the highest privilege that the gospel offers, higher even than justification. Why are we justified? For the sake of relationship. For the sake of our adoption into his family. And so here is the picture. When we say that God is love and we recognize our unworthiness, this is the message. And now we want to spend the balance of our time together bringing these pieces together, the meaning of love, the message of love, into the mission of love that God has given to us. Jesus says in John 13, verse 35, by this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. All people will know that you're my disciples if you have love for one another. Now, I remember first reading Francis Schaeffer's book, The Mark of the Christian, and found myself deeply disturbed by this statement. He said, the church is to be a loving church in a dying culture. Upon Christ's authority, he gives the world the right to judge whether you and I are actually born-again Christians on the basis of our observable love toward all Christians. There is a test that God has given to the world. Look at the church. Look at those who name the name of Jesus Christ as their Savior and as their Lord. Should you believe them? Indeed, is what they're saying even true? Here's the living proof. Right here. Where's the love? That's the standard of the world's evaluation of us. Sobering. Powerful. Let's unpack this just a little bit. Love, of course, is the cornerstone of Christian living. It is first a command. Jesus says, "A new command I give you, that you love one another." That's the verse that precedes by this, "All men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." A new command, which is not a new command. It's just that it's a new community. And so he's starting from the very base building block. What really is important, what sums it all up in terms of the conduct, the way of living that Christ calls us to, is love. Love for one another. And then, two, and importantly, love as the cornerstone of Christian living is not merely a matter of exercising the will to do the right thing. That's what a command is. Exercising our will to do the right thing. But love also, and in a more even basic way, I suppose, is the effect of the work of God in our lives. And so, John tells us, we love because he first loved us. Remember, Jesus said, he who has been forgiven little loves little. But she who has been forgiven much loves much. It is the measure of our understanding of the generosity and goodness of God for us. The grace that he has shown us as undeserving enemies of God, that we demonstrate Christ-like love. We are trophies of his mercy. It is to the extent that we really get it and really understand the depths of his mercy, when we can really, with Paul, say, "I don't know of anyone more sinful than me." Paul says, "I'm the most sinful man there ever was, and that's why I understand the grace of God so deeply." Well, I just want you to know that you are the most sinful person you will ever meet. Nobody knows the depth of your corruption like you do. Right? And so it is in those moments where we allow that piece of insight to come to us, the great depths of God's forgiveness, that we, in response, and just it's reflexive in this way, desire to share the love that he has shown to us. Love is the mark of the person who has been shaped and molded by God. Love is the primary fruit of the Spirit, according to Paul in Galatians 5, verse 22. The fruit of the Spirit is love. Then he qualifies that: joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. Those are great qualities, but the center of it, the umbrella that kind of holds it all together, love, that's the mark of a person that is being shaped and molded by the Spirit of God. Love. Let's probe just a bit deeper, because this is where we need to come together and think through the application of these things. That we have a witness in our postmodern culture, in our post-Christian culture, in our post-industrial culture, in the culture that we have come to. There are unique cultural conditions that make the witness of a loving community especially powerful. And I want us to think about that with the time we have remaining in this first session. The thing that is going to speak to our culture even louder than our words, even more persuasively than our apologetics, and I believe in both of those things, of course, is the reality of authentic community. I've spent a lot of time interacting with non-Christians. I have a deep passion and a love for those conversations, and I feel kind of weird if I don't have a conversation that's ongoing with a non-Christian in my life at any particular time. And what I have seen over these many years with the many non-Christian friends that I have had is I've sought to share my faith and help them discover what I have found, is that there are two questions in the minds of every non-Christian. One is what you're saying to me true? And the second one is, could I ever really see myself being one of you? And the reality, my friends, the second question trumps the first. It just does. And so there is an imperative, especially in our culture, that the Christian community reflect this challenge of Jesus Christ. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. Because that is the thing that shows the truth of what we have to say. We live in a culture that is saturated by isolated individualism. The thing about the West in general and about America in particular is our individualism. There's a lot of value in that because that promotes individual conviction, initiative, ingenuity. Many of the things that we really appreciate about our culture are rooted in the elevation of the individual. But there is with that a significant danger, a danger that from the very beginning of this project called the American Way was observed by those from the outside. And so in 1830, a French sociologist began to explore this new country. Alexis de Tocqueville wrote a book called Democracy in America. And he was one who had deep appreciation for what America had become in those few decades. But he also issued a warning that I think is deeply prophetic, even down to our own day. De Tocqueville coined the term individualism, and he said, individualism is a calm and considered feeling which disposes each citizen to isolate himself from the mass of his fellows and withdraw into the circle of family and friends. With this little society formed to his taste, he gladly leaves the greater society to look after itself. And so he says, each man is forever thrown back on himself alone. And there is danger that he may be shut up in the solitude of his own heart. Well, I think truer words have never been said about the nature, the heart, the spirit of our culture, which is so deeply individualistic. And to probe just a bit deeper, let's ask ourselves this question: how isolated are we really as a culture? And this has been the subject of sociological research for decades. And about a decade or so ago, the book Bowling Alone came out, Robert Putnam's study on individualism in America. And there's no way you can read what I've got up here. So you basically want to follow the waves down. And let me just fill in the gaps for you. What Putnam is demonstrating through pretty clear social research is that every generation, beginning in 1900 and working down to people born in 1970, there is a a growing disintegration of social relationships, of social context. The process of people who are individuals who are becoming increasingly isolated, participation in civic organization, participation in church, participation in voting, reading newspapers, and many other of the indices of shared communal activity, shared societal vision, these things are being lost. And so that when we speak of isolation today, we really are driving this to a pretty extreme place, according to current research. The University of Chicago started an organization called the National Opinion Research Center some years ago to begin to study in a scientific way where the soul of our culture really is. And their most recent study on this subject demonstrates that 25% of adults have no one with whom to discuss matters of importance to them. 1 in 4 people in our society have no one in their life with whom to interact about the deep things of their own experience, their own life, the struggles they face, the barriers that they confront, the confusion that they have, even their own response to the world around them. They have no one, by their own admission, to share these realities with. That is a deeply isolated individual. No, that's an alienated individual. So far from the vision of love that we have described to this point. But the story gets in a certain way a little creepier. Because of the 75% of those who do have a confidant in their life, somebody with whom they can interact about matters of importance with them, 80% of those people, those adults, have only their nuclear family to engage the important questions of their life and existence with. Now, what does that mean? That means that most people are just basically talking to themselves. And the idea that we would build community out of a culture like that, a culture in which 15 out of 100 adults on average have somebody outside their own home that they discuss things of importance with them. That is a very small number. And let's add to this the reality, the truth as well. According to Pew Research and other places that are competent in these studies, that between 30 and 40% of the American population self-identifies as evangelical. Now, what does that mean? Even if all those 15 out of the 40 were people who are part of our Christian fellowships, it would still be a minority of our Christian community. Do you see the point? What's true of the culture, its deep alienation, is also and in many ways equally true of the church itself. Where is that witness that through which by all men will know that we are his disciples if we are deeply alienated as the church, as the culture is alienated? The team of sociologists from University of California, San Diego, draw these conclusions from this data. This change, and it's tracked every 10 years, and it's a significant downward trajectory, indicates that something's not good for our society. Ties with a close network of people create a safety network. It keeps us sane. It keeps us centered. It keeps us social. It keeps us healthy. And to remove ourselves over time as a people from those contexts, super dangerous. Let's go again, just yet another step, a little deeper, that the isolated individualism that is a measurable phenomenon in our society also is leading to a measurable breakdown of trust relationships, especially among the emerging generation, the 20-somethings, the so-called millennials. And again, there's a fairly significant amount of data, I've just given a few examples of it here, that conclude that 84% of millennials say that most people simply cannot be trusted. Sherry Turkle at MIT has a great TED talk on her book Alone Together, in which she talks about the effect of technology on social bonding, on relationships, and how over not a long period of time, young people have learned to relate in a way that is just utterly disconnected from the personal. You can say whatever you want on a tweet or a text. I mean, we're living in a world where a presidential election is being conducted on Twitter. That's frightening, my friends. That's frightening. It's not dialogue, debate, discussion about ideas. It's bumper sticker. And this is how people are learning to relate to one another. Here's a conclusion based upon this data that I find interesting from McAllister. She says, could it really be, she's comparing people who grew up in the 70s, people in my generation with millennials, people who are in their 20s now. Could it really be that a bad economy, violence, scandals, and strife have caused this deep-seated skepticism among millennials, where 84% of them believe that most people simply are not trusted, you cannot trust them? It doesn't seem so, she says, when you consider life wasn't much different and was probably a lot worse in some respects. Some of us remember the gas lines of the 1970s and things like that. It was probably worse in some respects, she says, in the 70s, including a bad economy, higher violent crime rate, conflicts over the Vietnam War, the impeachment of President Nixon, an increase in drug use compared to previous generations, and a decline in the standard of living. The 70s have been described as a decade of anger, disillusionment, bitterness, and cynicism. That's the problem in your life, you who have gray hair or no hair. You grew up with that. She goes on, she says, if violence is the problem that produces this lack of trust, then it seems millennials today should be more trusting than those in the 70s. Because why? Because the crime rate actually is significantly down. Of course, one of the problems could be that millennials perceive there is more violence because of the 24-hour news cycle and the exaggerating effect of the internet, as people think bad things are happening all the time, even though they don't see it themselves. This is certainly part of the perception, but I think there's more going on here than just violence, real or perceived. She concludes, trust is built when you know someone, when you have mutual understanding, a kind of civic love. See, this completely secular thinker has her finger right on the pulse. The answer to alienation and the answer to the crisis of trust in our culture is love. That's astute. That's profound. That's an opportunity. Let's go back to our position here. I want to suggest to you this, as complicated as our culture is, and it's getting more complicated perhaps, we are becoming more and more secular as a culture indeed. That's measurable, we know that. But I would like to suggest to you this, that the biggest barrier to effective witness is not the culture at all, but it is the church itself. See, the one constant is they will know that you are my disciples and that you love one another. That doesn't change. Even when cultures change in a significant way. The first century Roman world was every bit as cynical and alienated as our own. All of the literature of the first century Roman world is just saturated with cynicism, with Juvenal's satires and things that, of this nature, that really bring into focus the life of normal people. But it was the living witness of the early church that spoke so powerfully to this cynical and alienated generation. Tertullian, the father of the second century church, put it this way very famously. He says, "It is our care of the helpless, our practice of loving kindness that brands us in the eyes of many of our opponents. Look," they say, "look at how they love one another." Oh, yeah. It's that. It's the evidence of Christian love that just cuts through like a hot knife in butter. The cynicism, the despair that so characterizes our day and sensitizes that deep thing within that everyone is seeking. Love that is without condition, without merit, that accepts me fully for who I am, where I am. Everyone needs that love. So our question is that what comes to most people's minds when they think about the church today? If we had a thing where we went out to the university campus or down in the business district or Broad and High or something like that, a little survey, it's one question survey. The word that comes to my mind when thinking the church about the church is blank. What would it be? Just going to hazard a guess. Probably not love. Probably not. Probably narrowly defined moral codes, intolerance, things that are both true and caricatures of the church. But we are not doing a great job of being the people that God calls us to be to accomplish the task that He has called us to accomplish. And we just really need to think about that question. The world has a right to give the negative verdict to the church because Jesus gave it to them. And it is only within our power to change that. That's the one thing we can do. Let's think about that. What is the church after all? The church is a household. We're the family of God, brothers and sisters. Do we relate to one another in that deep way? Family, loyalty, permanent love values, things that no matter who you are or where you've come from or what you did and what you're going to do, you're still my brother. You're still my brother. And there's that loyalty and affection that comes. The body is, the church is the body. And an organic, living network of interrelatedness and interdependence. In an individualistic culture, we surely say, the eye can say to the hand, I have no need of you. But the Christian must agree with Paul and say, no. All of the members matter. We are mutually interdependent. I need you in the same way that you need me. And it is being caught up in the value system of our culture that celebrates the individual in isolation from the body that is crippling the witness of the church and the process of maturity producing Christians who bear love as the fruit of the Spirit. And lastly, we think of the church as the bride of Christ, His beloved. How much more intimate can you get than that? That's how God feels towards us. I remember when I was contemplating proposing to my wife 36 years ago. I would just lay there in my bed and I would be thinking about it. I couldn't sleep. I was agitated. She just was on my mind all the time. It's kind of crazy. She still is. And I'm still kind of crazy. But there's a passion there, a singularity of focus on the relational level. And that passion is the same passion that God has for you. Yeah, he does. He has that incredible preoccupying passion for you. And therefore, we ought to have that for one another as well. We are the beloved of Christ. And just to reflect on who we are as a people of God and to get our theology about the church right is just so absolutely critical to our own spiritual health and to our witness to the world. Church has never been created to be insular as some kind of a weird subculture within the broader culture, and its action in the culture never uncalculated but intensely directive, strategic, and indeed even goal-centered. And in describing the living dynamic that took a movement of some 70 people huddled in an upper room in Jerusalem out of fear for the fact that their Lord had been murdered as a prisoner of the state, to a movement of as much as a million in the first century of the church, and over the process of 300 years, the consensus within the culture that happened for reasons like this. Rodney Stark, in his book, The Rise of Christianity, goes through a number of test cases about how it is that this ramshackle group won the day in their society, in their culture. And he summarizes it. He says, Christianity revitalized life in Greco-Roman cities by providing new norms and new kinds of social relationships able to cope with many urgent urban problems. The way that they lived answered the problems, the questions, the dilemmas that their contemporaries faced. To cities filled with the homeless and impoverished, Christianity offered clarity as well as hope. To cities filled with newcomers and strangers, Christianity offered an immediate basis for attachments. To cities filled with orphans and widows, Christianity provided a new and expanded sense of family. To cities torn by violent ethnic strife, Christianity offered a new basis for social solidarity. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. All are one in the body of Christ, Paul says in Galatians 3:28. And those things meant something to them. That was on their mind. That was a part of their intent. To love the culture the way that they had been taught to love one another. And the way that went down, and we are the legacy of that, is the same way it's going to go down today. Our questions, our solutions, I'm sorry to say, are not political. That may play a role, and people disagree on what that looks like. They are not economic, primarily, although economics certainly plays a role. The answer to our culture is the church. Do you understand that? Do you believe that? The answer to our culture is the church. It's how we choose to obey the living God and love one another in such a way that the world looks on and says, behold how they love one another. I'd like to get in on some of that myself. Do we believe that the love of Christ has the same transformative effect today that it did in those early centuries of the church? Do you believe that? Have you just caved into the same cynicism that seems to be governing the rest of our society? There's no hope, so I'll just retreat into the world of my own private concerns. That's tragically the way, unfortunately, the majority of Christians live their lives. We've got to be different. We've got to be different. That's really what this conference is all about. We want to provide some framework, some practicals about what does it mean to really be this robust community of Christ followers who love one another in such a way that the world steps back and takes notice and says, "Behold, how they love one another." And so that's what we're here to do. And so there's a challenge to you then as an individual. Are you prepared to step up and to play your role, your part? Now's the time for you to come to terms with your own isolation, with your own crippling individualism, with your own disobedient concern for yourself above the rest of God's body that He's placed you in. And to tangibly, practically, consistently, authentically enter into love relationships. And as we do that, we're going to shape the churches that we are from here. And we are going to set ourselves up as a living witness to the reality that the cynicism that so pervades our day and is crippling our young people today absolutely has an answer. But it rests with us. It's very simple and yet very profound. And that's what we're here to discuss.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.